Welcome to Managing AML. I am Dr. Harry Erba. Today I will review new cytotoxic agents in secondary and treatment-related AML. This slide summarizes my disclosures. The learning objectives of today's program include how to identify the prevalence, characteristics, and clinical impact of secondary AML and treatment-related AML, outline the current treatment options for secondary and treatment-related AML, and describe the standard of care for incorporating therapeutic strategies into the treatment of patients with secondary AML and treatment-related AML. We have been able to identify a number of prognostic factors in our patients with acute myeloid leukemia. Some of these are related to the biology of the patient and their ability to tolerate intensive therapy, such as age, performance status, and comorbid conditions. However, many others are related to the sensitivity of the acute myeloid leukemia to currently available therapies. We are aware that cytogenetic and molecular abnormalities are quite important in determining prognosis. But today, we are going to focus on antecedent hematologic disorders leading to AML, so-called secondary AML, and AML following prior cytotoxic chemotherapy or radiation therapy, so-called treatment-related AML. An interesting area of clinical investigation at this time is the use of sensitive techniques for measurable residual disease following initial therapy and how that might help in prognostication and therapeutic selection, but is not the topic of today's discussion. We know that the incidence of acute myeloid leukemia secondary to prior therapy and prior antecedent hematologic disorders increases with age, as can be seen in this data from a Swedish registry study. Recently, a Danish registry has been published and has been quite informative on the outcomes of patients with secondary AML or treatment-related AML. In this registry, there were over 3,000 AML patients. Nearly 20% had secondary AML, and 6.6% had therapy-related AML. Of this number, approximately half, or 1,567, received intensive chemotherapy. Patients with de novo AML or treatment-related AML were more likely to receive intensive chemotherapy than those patients with secondary AML following a prior myelodysplastic syndrome or non-myelodysplastic syndrome, such as a myeloproliferative neoplasm. In this slide, you can see the distribution of the previous disease states by the diagnosis of either therapy-related AML or secondary AML. In terms of therapy-related AML, slightly over half of the patients had a prior solid tumor malignancy treated with chemotherapy and/or radiation therapy. However, approximately a third also had lymphoproliferative disorders, and the remaining patients had other cancers such as multiple myeloma and acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and even 10% of patients had rheumatic diseases for which they received alkylating agents such as cyclophosphamide. In terms of secondary AML, the majority of patients had a prior history of a myelodysplastic syndrome. Patients who received intensive chemotherapy for the diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia had a superior survival at both 90 days and 1 year compared to patients who received no therapy. In the intensively treated patients, those with de novo AML had a 90-day mortality of 15% compared to slightly higher in patients with secondary and treatment-related AML. At 3 years, patients with AML secondary to MDS or secondary to a non-MDS condition or treatment-related AML had lower survival compared to those patients with de novo AML, and the highest risk of death at 3 years was in patients with non-MDS secondary AML. The impact of the diagnosis of secondary AML and treatment-related AML was more profound in younger patients than in patients over the age of 60, where the prognosis of patients with AML in general is quite poor. Likewise, the effect of cytogenetic risk group was more apparent in these patients with secondary AML and treatment-related AML if they had a favorable or intermediate risk karyotype compared to those patients with AML, whether de novo, secondary, or treatment-related, who had adverse risk karyotypes. The risk of therapy-related AML in adults varies, likely due to the different treatment regimens for the different malignancies, and the survival following the primary neoplasm or condition for which the patient received chemotherapy or radiation therapy. But in general, the risk of AML was nearly fivefold higher or increased after chemo or therapy or radiation therapy. Approximately 7% of newly adult AML patients in this registry between 75 and 2008 had therapy-related AML. You can see the highest relative increase in the risk of therapy-related AML was seen in patients with bone and joint malignancies, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and myeloma. There are different routes to leukemogenesis depending on the agent targeting the marrow. Patients who have received topoisomerase II inhibitors, such as anthracyclines or etoposide, typically present with a shorter latency without a prior history of myelodysplastic syndrome, and frequently have translocations involving the MLL gene on chromosome 11q23, or actually have fusion genes that have been associated with a relatively good prognosis in de novo AML, such as the core binding factor translocations 821 and inversion 16, and even therapy-related APL has been defined. Patients with an 11q23 abnormality often have monoblastic morphology. On the other hand, alkylating agents and radiation that involves a large amount of hematopoietic marrow typically leads to AML with a longer latency and a smoldering history suggestive of myelodysplastic syndrome. Cytogenetic abnormalities in these patients typically include complex karyotypic changes, both structural and numeric, as well as aberrations of chromosomes 5 and 7. The survival of patients with treatment-related AML, specifically with favorable risk karyotype, is worse than those patients with a favorable risk karyotype and de novo AML, as can be seen in this analysis published by Kern and colleagues. Likewise, in two studies, retrospective analyses of data from MD Anderson Cancer Center, you can see that the overall survival of patients with therapy-related AML with either the core binding factor translocation 821 or inversion 16 is worse than patients with de novo AML and those same core binding factor translocations. However, in regard to the relapse rate, for patients with inversion 16, there was really no significant difference in the risk of relapse, and yet the overall survival of these patients was worse. This suggests that patients with therapy-related AML may have competing causes of mortality, such as the primary malignancy for which they were treated. Furthermore, they may be less able to tolerate intensive therapeutic options that patients with de novo AML can tolerate. Likewise, survival following therapy-related AML for those patients with an intermediate-risk karyotype is worse than patients with an intermediate-risk karyotype that have de novo AML. In terms of the mutational profile of patients with therapy-related AML, these patients are more likely to have P53 mutations as well as mutations in the ABC transporter genes compared to patients who have de novo AML. I'd like to now focus on a very interesting analysis from patients who were treated on a prior phase 3 study for secondary and therapy-related AML. In this clinical trial, patients were randomized between an investigational drug, amonified with cytarabine, versus daunorubicin with cytarabine. There was no difference in response rates or overall survival. However, samples were collected from these patients who had clinically defined treatment-related and secondary AML. When a mutational analysis was performed on these patients and compared to patients who clinically were felt to have de novo AML, patients with secondary and treatment-related AML were more likely to have mutations in chromatin modifier genes, such as ASXL1 and EZH2, as well as spliceosome mutations. The investigators in this study then classified patients who apparently had de novo AML, who were not treated in this clinical trial, based on the mutational profile identified in secondary AML. So these patients were felt to have either a de novo or pan AML type genotype, or secondary AML genotype, or P53 mutated genotype. Among patients over the age of 60 with clinically defined de novo AML versus secondary AML, the CR rates were lower if the patient had a de novo AML yet with a secondary type AML mutational profile. And again, similar to what was seen in the clinical trial of patients with clinically defined secondary AML. Likewise, there appears to be relative chemotherapy resistance in patients with secondary type AML and those with P53 mutated AML. Patients with those two types of AML were more likely to require two cycles of induction chemotherapy to achieve a complete remission. Ultimately, the event-free survival of patients who clinically appear to have de novo AML was worse if by genotype that secondary type AML mutations, the chromatin modifiers, the spliceosome mutations, or P53 mutation, compared to those patients with clinically defined de novo AML who had the de novo or pan AML mutational profile. Turning now to acute myeloid leukemia with myelodysplasia-related changes, the WHO classifies this type of AML as those patients who have 20% or more bone marrow blasts or circulating blasts with any of the following criteria: a prior history of myelodysplastic syndrome or an MDS-MPN, such as atypical CML or chronic myelomonocytic leukemia, an MDS-related cytogenetic abnormality, of which there are many, but the ones that are most common are those with complex cytogenetic changes, both numeric and structural changes in chromosomes, and those patients with chromosomes 5 and 7 abnormalities, and specifically 17p deletions. And then finally, patients with multilineage dysplasia and greater than 50% of at least two cell lineages, but in the absence of more favorable risk genotypes of nucleophosmin mutation or biallelic CEBP alpha mutations. I'd like to look at, in a little bit more depth, the inclusion of multilineage dysplasia as an independent prognostic feature. An analysis was done of patients in Germany receiving intensive chemotherapy as classified by the WHO system with AML with myelodysplasia-related changes. As you could see, about 50% of patients in this cohort had AML with myelodysplasia-related changes defined solely based on the presence of multilineage dysplasia. When the event-free and overall survival of those patients was compared to patients with myelodysplasia-related changes as defined by a prior history of a hematologic disorder such as MDS or MDS-related cytogenetic changes, the outcome was actually superior. And in fact, the outcome of patients with AML with multilineage dysplasia alone as their qualifying characteristic for myelodysplasia-related changes was no different than patients with AML not otherwise specified. Part of this effect does appear to be due to the fact that patients with nucleophosmin mutation and biallelic CEBP alpha mutation, regardless of dysplasia, have a more favorable outcome. And that is why the WHO has now included the caveat that multilineage dysplasia cannot be diagnosed in the presence of those two mutations. So I'd like to summarize what we've gone through so far. the outcomes following standard intensive cytotoxic chemotherapy in patients with secondary and therapy-related AML is quite poor. Now, part of this is due to the disease biology with a differing cytogenetic profile, and as I have shown you, a mutational profile that has higher incidence of P53 mutations, but also chromatin modifier and spliceosome mutations. However, we need to remember that both therapy-related AML and secondary AML are more common with advancing age, and older patients, especially those with prior exposure to chemotherapy, may not tolerate intensive chemotherapy as well. We've also learned over the years that intensification of the standard 7+3 induction regimen with higher doses of cytarabine and or higher doses of daunorubicin, and even intensification of post-remission therapy with high-dose ARA-C has not led to improvements in the outcomes of patients with secondary AML and therapy-related AML. And so in these subtypes of patients, we still attempt to get these patients into a remission and proceed with allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplantation that has likely the highest chance of prolonged disease-free survival. So I believe based on this retrospective data, it's clear that novel therapeutic approaches should be strongly considered for these patients. And with that, I would like to turn to liposomal daunorubicin cytarabine. It has been known for decades, based on in vitro studies, that combinations of cytotoxic agents can be either synergistic, additive, or even antagonistic, depending on the molar ratio of two agents that are used to treat neoplastic cell lines in vitro. This has been shown in preclinical AML studies, where a 1-to-5 molar ratio of daunorubicin to cytarabine has been shown to be synergistic. Now, in order to test the hypothesis that this 1-to-5 molar ratio is critical for improving outcomes, patients would need to be treated with those drugs in that ratio. Now, of course, when we give standard daunorubicin cytarabine, it is a 3-day bolus injection of daunorubicin on top of a 7-day continuous infusion of cytarabine. But regardless of the regimen, the molar ratio would not be maintained. And so to test the hypothesis that the molar ratio is important biologically and in vivo, these drugs, daunorubicin and cytarabine, would need to be encapsulated in a liposome in that 1-to-5 molar ratio. CPX351 or liposomal daunorubicin cytarabine is such a 1-to-5 molar ratio of daunorubicin to cytarabine in 100 nanometer bilamellar liposomes. In order for the daunorubicin to be incorporated into the liposome, copper is used in this process, making the agent a brilliant purple color. What has been found in preclinical studies is that by encapsulating daunorubicin cytarabine in this 1-to-5 molar ratio and specifically into these liposomes, that the agent targets the marrow and preferentially targets leukemic compared to normal marrow progenitors. This led to a number of phase 1 studies and ultimately a randomized phase 2 study of CPX351 versus 7 and 3 in previously untreated AML patients over the age of 60. As can be seen on the right-hand side of the slide, there was no difference in overall survival regardless of whether the patient received CPX351 or 7 and 3. However, in a subset analysis of patients with secondary AML, those defined as having AML following an antecedent hematologic disorder or therapy-related AML, CPX351 was associated with a higher response rate, a lower 60-day mortality, and higher event-free and overall survival. However, this was a randomized phase 2 study that was not powered to show a benefit in this subset of patients. However, this randomized phase 2 study led to the pivotal phase 3 study showed on this next slide, where patients between the ages of 60 and 75 who were eligible for chemotherapy with adequate performance status were randomized between CPX351 and 7 and 3 induction if they had high-risk disease as defined as therapy-related AML, AML with a history of myelodysplastic syndrome with or without a prior HMA exposure, AML with a history of the MDS-MPN chronic myelomonocytic leukemia, and even de novo AML with an MDS-type karyotype. Patients would receive CPX-351 on days 1, 3, and 5 as a 90-minute infusion. 7 and 3 was cytarabine 100 milligrams per meter squared by continuous infusion for 7 days, and daunorubicin 60 milligrams per meter squared days 1, 2, and 3. If the patients had cytoreduction at day 14 but persistent disease, they would receive a second cycle of CPX-351 for 2 days or 5 and 2 chemotherapy as shown on the slide. Patients achieving a remission went on to receive 2 more cycles of chemotherapy according to their initial randomization. If randomized to CPX-351, they would receive CPX-351 at a lower dose on days 1 and 3, or cytarabine and daunorubicin in a 5+2 schedule. Patients were allowed to go on to allogeneic transplant if eligible, and the primary endpoint of the study was survival. Now, it's important to look at a number of details of this study. First, the patient population was selected again based on the subset analysis of the prior randomized phase 2 study. Neither that study nor this one has addressed the use of CPX-351 in younger patients, which I'll come back to. The second is the liposomal formulation of daunorubicin cytarabine actually have lower doses of those two agents compared to what would be received in 7+3 followed by 5+2. The third observation is the use of the same agents during consolidation and not using a higher dose chemotherapy regimen such as high-dose cytarabine. Some have criticized this study based on that. However, there is no data that high-dose cytarabine, especially in older patients with secondary AML, is a benefit when given in the post-remission setting. This study, in fact, was a perfect experiment comparing the use of daunorubicin cytarabine given in the standard infusional, continuous infusion and bolus manner versus the liposomal formulation of the exact same two drugs, but yet in a lower complete or total dosage. The primary endpoint of the study was overall survival. And in fact, patients who received CPX-351 during induction, followed by consolidation with or without transplant, versus those who got 7 and 3, followed by 5 and 2 with or without transplant, had a superior survival. The median survival increased from approximately 6 months with 7+3 to 9.5 months with CPX-351. At 12 months, more patients were alive if they had been randomized to receive CPX-351, 42%, compared to 7+3, 28%. These differences were statistically significant. There was also, as expected from the randomized phase 2 study, a higher response rate with CPX-351. CRs were achieved in 37% of patients with CPX-351 versus 26% of patients with 7 and 3. And if you include CRI, it was nearly 50% with CPX-351 compared to a third of patients with 7 and 3. In patients who are older, between 70 and 75, and even those with adverse risk karyotype, there was a trend for an improvement or a higher CR and CRI rate, as well as a CR rate compared to 7 and 3. Although, since the numbers in these subsets were smaller, the differences were not statistically significant in the subsets. But in the entire group, the response rates were higher with CPX-351 versus 7 and 3. In terms of the benefit of CPX-351 versus 7 and 3 in older patients in terms of survival, again, looked at by the stratifications, there was a benefit of CPX-351 in patients between 70 and 75, those with therapy-related AML, those with AML following prior myelodysplastic syndrome, those with AML following chronic myelomonocytic leukemia. There was a trend for patients who had adverse karyotypes, FLT3 mutation, as well as having received HMAs in the past. The survival benefit was even seen in patients between the ages of 70 and 75, as can be seen in these Kaplan-Meier curves. Furthermore, more patients proceeded at some point during their therapy to allogeneic stem cell transplant if they were assigned to CPX351 versus 7 and 3. And in fact, for patients over the age of 70, about a quarter of patients proceeded to allogeneic transplant following CPX351 versus 11% following 7 plus 3. A landmark analysis was then done at the time of allogeneic transplant and showed that patients who proceeded to allogeneic transplant following CPX351 had a superior survival with a plateau on this curve above 60% at 24 months compared to patients who went on to allogeneic transplant versus 7 and 3. There was a 53% rate of fewer deaths within 100 days of transplant following CPX351 versus 7 and 3. Now, the explanation for this is unclear. Some have speculated that CPX351 may lead to a stronger, better, deeper, complete remission. However, MRD analysis was not part of this clinical trial. It's also possible that patients who received CPX351 had less toxicities and tolerated the transplant better. However, I don't think that would explain the difference in survival that is seen at 24 months. Now looking at toxicity, there were fewer deaths during the first 30 days or 60 days after beginning induction in patients who received CPX351 versus 7 and 3. In an analysis by the investigators at day 60, the investigators felt that the risk of death related to adverse events was similar between CPX351 and 7 and 3, approximately 10%. However, there were more deaths in the 7 plus 3 arm due to progressive acute myeloid leukemia. In terms of other toxicities, there did not seem to be a major difference in these other adverse events, including febrile neutropenia, pneumonia, hypotension, hypoxia, and others. However, there was a higher rate of all grades of hemorrhage with CPX351 versus 7 and 3, as well as fatal CNS hemorrhages with CPX351, 2% versus 0.7%. The toxicity that was most obvious that differed between the two treatment regimens was myelosuppression. The recovery of ANC and platelet count following CPX351 was longer, took longer than patients following 7 and 3. So if you look at patients who achieved a complete remission just following one cycle of induction, the median day number of days to a ANC over 500 was 35 days with CPX351 versus 7 and 3 with, I'm sorry, versus 29% with 7 and 3. The study allowed GCSF and myeloid growth factors to be given in some of these patients. Likewise, there was a longer time to recovery of the platelet count over 50,000. The median time with CPX351 was 36 days versus 29 days. So in summary, after decades of attempting to improve the clinical outcome of patients with acute myeloid leukemia, and specifically those with treatment-related AML and AML with myelodysplasia-related changes based on cytogenetics or based on that history of myelodysplastic syndrome or other MDS-MPNs, liposomal daunorubicin cytarabine is the first and it's the only agent that is shown to improve overall survival in this group of patients when used as initial therapy and led to the labeled indication approval in August of 2017 for adults with therapy-related AML and AML with myelodysplasia-related changes. There are a number of questions that remain. The pivotal trial that led to the approval was performed in older patients with therapy-related AML and AML with myelodysplasia-related changes. The question is, would the benefit also be seen in younger patients with this disease? For all younger patients with secondary AML, more intensive regimens have not been shown to lead to improvements in survival. And since the disease is biologically likely very similar in younger and older patients, I think it is reasonable to treat younger patients with therapy-related AML and AML with myelodysplasia-related changes with liposomal doxorubicin cytarabine. Of course, we would love to have a better biomarker for the predictor of response. Not all patients responded. Not all patients seemed to benefit. However, we look forward to further analysis of samples from patients in these studies in terms of mutational profile to see if there is some predictor of response to the liposomal formulation. Over 95% of patients received CPX-351 as an inpatient during the clinical trial. Now, for consolidation, half of the patients received it as an outpatient because these patients tended to be well by that point, have recovered from induction, and their bone marrows have recovered. The question is it safe to give CPX-351 to an initially diagnosed patient during initial induction? If this is attempted, I would recommend that patients be monitored very closely with appropriate transfusion support. And then finally, liposomal doxorubicin cytarabine was compared to the standard of care for patients who are fit for chemotherapy, and that is 7 plus 3 chemotherapy, which has been our gold standard for 7 and 3 for 40 years. 7 and 3 has been that gold standard. However, it's not clear that more intensive approaches would be beneficial compared to less intensive approaches as newer therapeutic options emerge for patients receiving less intensive therapy. And so in patients who are fit for chemotherapy, it remains to be evaluated whether a less intensive therapeutic option may have any benefit compared to liposomal doxorubicin cytarabine. However, for patients who are felt to be fit for intensive chemotherapy, there is no doubt based on the randomized phase III study and the prior randomized phase II study that liposomal doxorubicin and cytarabine is a clinical benefit for this group of patients with therapy-related AML and AML with MRC based on higher response rates, based on better and higher overall survival, based on a higher chance to proceed to an allogeneic transplant, which in many patients is the only potential option for curative therapy for these subsets of disease, as well as a lower 30 and 60-day mortality. I'd like to thank you for viewing this activity.